our lives. We bless you and thank you. Amen. Very good. So this portion is called Assembled Parts, and you'll see why in a minute. Now, the passage that it's based upon is Exodus 39. They brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent, and all its implements, its hooks, panels.
Recording stopped.
The tent and all its implements, its hooks, panels, connecting bars, pillars, and foundation sockets. So, very good. There's Joseph. Good to see you. And Bob and Jen are back. So, we're just getting started on the essay. To the casual reader, the names by which the 54 parashiot or parashot sections of the annual Torah reading cycle are called seem quite incidental. A parasha is almost always named after the first distinctive word or phrase to appear in its text. Hasidic teaching, however, which sees every event and phenomenon as determined by divine providence, rejects the very concept of incidents. Furthermore, the name of an object in the holy tongue constitutes its soul and essence. So there certainly cannot be anything incidental about the name of a section of Torah. The same is true of the two concluding parashiot in the book of Exodus, Vayechel and Pekudei. Vayechel is the portion that we read last week, and Pekudei is today's portion. The interesting thing, however, is that the names of these two parashiot, which follow each other in the Torah, and in certain years are even joined together to form a simple reading, express two opposite ideas. The name Vayechel, which is related to the Hebrew word for community, evokes the concept of collectivity, whereas Pekudei, to be counted, brings to mind the significance of the individual as a unit. So these two parashot express the conflict, interaction, and paradox of two features of the human soul: our need and desire to bond together in a communal identity, and our need and desire for an individual identity distinct and unique from our fellows. Even more interesting, if we look beyond the names, Vayechel and Pekudei, to their actual content, we discover that the two parashot seem to have switched names. The content of the parasha that carries the name Vayechel would seem to be more appropriately named Pekudei, while the content of the parasha of Pekudei begs the name Vayechel. Vayechel begins by relating how Moses assembled the people of Israel to instruct them on the observance of Shabbat and the making of the tabernacle. This act of assembly gives the parasha its name. Vayechel means, "and he assembled," and is a form of the word kahal, the Hebrew word for congregation. But the remainder of the parasha is filled with the particulars of the tabernacle's construction. Each of the tabernacle's dozens of components is individually listed and described. The roof coverings, the wall panels, the foundation sockets, pillars, braces, brackets, and curtains, the ark, the table, the menorah, the two altars, and even the wash basin and its pedestal. We are given the exact dimensions of each of these components, the materials out of which they were made, and the details of their design. Pekudei means accounts, and the parsha begins with the statement, "these are the accounts of the tabernacle," and it's a statement regarding all of the materials, the collection of the materials that were made for the tabernacle. The etymological root, pakod, means to count. to remember and to appoint, expressing the idea of itemization, a particular attention to detail. But while Pekudei also includes details of the tabernacle's construction, specifically those of the priestly garments, a major part of the parasha is devoted to the tabernacle's assembly. In Pekudei, the Torah relates how the components listed and described in Vayachel were fitted together to form the tabernacle, and how the divine presence came to dwell in the completed structure. In other words, the parasha of Vayachel is taken up with the individual natures of the tabernacle's parts, while the parasha of Pekudei describes how these are combined to form a greater structure, the very opposite of what each parasha's name means. So, there are five lessons that the Rebbe discusses here, and we'll talk about them in detail. To summarize, the Torah includes a parasha called Vayechel and a parasha called Pekudei. In certain years, they are joined as a single reading called Vayechel Pekudei. In other years, these two parashot form two separate Torah readings read on separate weeks, like they happen to during this year's cycle. Vayechel means community, but the content of this parasha is the value of individuality. Pekudei implies individuality, but its content is the advantage in union and integration. Vayechel comes first in the Torah, followed by Pekudei. Each of these nuances is significant. Each illuminates the relationship between our individual and community identity. So, lesson one, we have and need them both. The fact that the Torah contains two parashot, one called Vayechel and the other called Pekudei, teaches us that our need for community and our striving for individual distinction are both important and desirable components of the human soul. Lesson number two, we can achieve a synthesis of the two. If Vayechel and Pekudei were only to appear in the Torah as two separate parashiot, this would imply that while both are necessary, each has its time and place. There are times when our individual, communality must be emphasized to the negation of our individuality, and there are times when an assertion of individuality is called for, albeit disruptive to our communality. We would not know that the two could be integrated. The fact that on certain years Vayechel and Pekudei are joined to form a single reading teaches us that we can and should achieve a synthesis of the two, a community that is not a faceless mass, but a community of individuals, each contributing his or her distinct personality and capabilities towards the communal goal, with the community in turn providing the framework within which each can strive for his or her personal best. Lesson number three, we must also nurture each of the two as a thing of value in and of itself. On the other hand, if Vayechel and Pekudei appear only in their joint form, this would imply that the only desirable objective is the achievement of some sort of balance between these contrasting drives. A balance that may well entail a compromise of one or the other or of both. Perhaps our individuality has value only in that it contributes in some ways to the community. Or perhaps the sole function of the community is to provide a framework for the development of the individual. We would not know that each is also an end in unto itself. The fact that Vayikel and Pekudei also appear as two separate Torah readings teaches us that in addition to the objective of integrating the two, individuality and community, are valuable objectives in their own right as well. Individual perfection has value independent of how it contributes to the communal good, and the creation of a community is likewise an end unto itself, for it represents a state that is greater than the sum of its individual parts. Lesson number 4, each consists of the other. We have seen how community, Vayikel, and individuality, Pekudei, each represent a desirable goal, and how they can be integrated to form a third model, a community of individuals, Vayikel, Pekudei. But the Torah goes even further. It tells us that even when each is considered as an end unto itself, the two are inexorably bound with each other. This lesson is derived from the fact that the content of Vayikel is the nature of individual things, while Pekudei describes diverse parts being joined in a greater whole. The Torah is telling us that even when the objective is solely the creation of a perfect community, the most perfect community is a community of individuals who are fully exercising their individuality. As Pekudei, even as a parsha on its own, is comprised of manifestly individual parts. The Torah is also telling us that also when the sole objective is the realization of individual potential, an individual can optimally actualize their uniqueness only as a member of community, as the Parsha of Pekudei includes the creation of community. Lesson number 5, imperfect individuals make a perfect community. The question remaining is, which should come first? Logic would seem to dictate that individual development, Pekudei, should come before community building, Vayikel. First one needs the parts, and then one can assemble these parts into the greater organism. So the individual emphasis, it would seem, should be on the perfection of the individual, after which these perfected individuals could be knit into the ideal community. The Torah, however, places Vayikel before Pekudei, teaching us that the very opposite is the case. Our very first objective must be to bring people together, regardless of their individual state. Personal perfection will follow, fostered by the love and fellowship we show towards each other. So this last statement is obviously very important, particularly in terms of the way communities work, right? Our very first objective must be to bring people together, regardless of their individual state. Personal perfection will follow, but it's fostered by the love and fellowship we show towards each other in community. So community plays an important role in fostering the individuality of each member of the community, right? So there is a note regarding the portions that we can look at real quickly. Due to the varying lengths and configurations of the Jewish year, because 7 times every 19 years we add a leap month to the calendar, the month of Adar, Adar 1 and Adar 2, it's the last month of the holiday cycle. The holiday cycle beginning with the month of Nisan, which is coming up in a few days now. There are often less than 54 Shabbat readings in the course of the year. There are 54 portions, but less than 54 readings. Thus, the annual reading cycle includes 14 parashot that form 7 paired readings, which may in certain years be combined as a single reading. One of these pairs in the parashot is the parashot of Vayikel and Pekudei, and they are often studied together. They don't happen to be this year, but they are often studied together. So I want to talk about Vayikel again for a minute, and I want to share a passage with you from the book of Acts that reflects or represents what I often say about the assembly, about the kahal, about the kehilah or kehilot, the plural. Vayikel begins by relating how Moses assembled the people of Israel to instruct them on the observance of Shabbat and the making of the tabernacle. This act of assembly gives the parasha its name. Vayikel means, and he assembled, and is a form of the word kahal, the Hebrew word for congregation. Right? So here's a note from a well-known Greek lexicon. The Greeks had a well-developed vocabulary to describe their religious gatherings and offerings. Most of these terms are not found in the apostolic writings. The comparison of two words in particular, however, ekklesia and synagogue, derived from the verb sunago, to bring together, are of specific interest for biblical studies. Ekklesia was used in a very restricted sense, while synagogue was used very broadly. Synagogue was used especially for the cultic gatherings and various offerings to the pagan deities, right? And of course, synagogue is the Greek word from which we get the English word synagogue, right? A synagogue in Greek is a religious gathering, but of any type, right? It is used specifically for the cultic gatherings and various offerings offered to the pagan deities. And of course, the Greeks and Romans had a plethora of pagan deities. So they had altars, temples, virtually throughout the Greek and Roman world. So whenever groups got together to worship pagan deities, they were referred to as synagogues, okay? In the Septuagint, ekklesia, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible made in the 3rd century, beginning with the Torah in the 3rd century. Ekklesia translates only one Hebrew word, that is kahal, sometimes spelled with a Q, as here, sometimes spelled with a K, as we saw earlier. Kahal principally conveys the idea of a group of people assembling for a variety of purposes. The assembly, ekklesia, in Greek, kahal in Hebrew, never stands for a pagan religious gathering. Thus, from the Septuagint, it becomes clear that ekklesia was primarily used as an equivalent for kahal, a term which to some degree was itself a particular group within the people of God. Now, you've heard me talk about these things many times, but I guess it's important for me to show you that statements like this appear in print. This does not reflect an opinion of mine. This is the way the words work in their languages. Ekklesia comes from the Greek word ek, out of, and kalesis, a calling, right? So it means a calling out. But it is a gathering of citizens called out from their homes into some public place, an assembly, an assembly of the people convened at the public place of the council for the purpose of deliberating. It sometimes refers to the assembly of the Israelites in the Septuagint. It can refer to any gathering or throng of men assembled by chance or tumultuously, according to Thayer, which is another standard Greek lexicon of the Greek language. But notice that in the Septuagint, it never stands for a pagan religious gathering. And it isn't as if there aren't pagan religious gatherings described in the Bible. There are. But the word ecclesia from the Septuagint is never used for a pagan religious gathering. In the classical days of Athens, the ecclesia was the convened assembly of the people, a sort of town council. In the wider Greek world, ecclesia came to mean any duly convened assembly of citizens, right? But it's a convened assembly of citizens for a specific purpose or objective, just like the word synagogue, which is a religious assembly, just like the word sanhedria in Greek, which is a judicial assembly, right? We get the word sanhedrin from the Greek word sanhedria, which refers to a judicial assembly. It is questionable, this goes on to say, whether ecclesia was ever used in Greek society for a religious group, right? But the fact of the matter is, it is never used in Koine Greek for a religious group, right? So in Greek, it does not and cannot mean church, even though that's the way it is typically translated in English translations of the Greek text, right? But the fact of the matter is, Greek has a word for religious assemblies. They're called synagogues. And even though they can apply to pagan religious assemblies as well, that should have been the word that was used of the early assemblies of Messianic congregations, first century Messianic congregations at the time, right? The word church should never have been translated from the Greek word ekklesia. The use of ekklesia in the apostolic writings does not stem from the use of ekklesia in secular Greek, but from the use of ekklesia in the Septuagint. In other words, when apostolic authors use the word ekklesia in Greek, they don't mean ekklesia. They don't define ekklesia the way it's defined in Greek. Otherwise, it would be an inappropriate reference, right? But the audience to whom these apostolic authors are writing, they know that apostolic authors don't use the word ekklesia like it's used in Greek, but like the word kahal is used in Hebrew, or kehilah is used in Hebrew. A kehilah is a synagogue, right? A synagogue of Jews. That's what the word kahal refers to. There's an important passage, and I'd like you to follow with me. I know it's lengthy, but it's an important passage with regard to the way these words work. In Acts 19, when the crowd heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and all of them rushed into the theater together. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. Notice in verse 32, the assembly. Guess what the Greek word is for this assembly? The ecclesia was in confusion. Why does the NIV translate the word ekklesia as assembly in this passage when it translates the word ekklesia into the English word church in so many others? Right? If you look at verse 32, the church was in confusion, but of course this wasn't a church. This was an assembly of citizens of the city. And they were in an uproar because of how successful Paul was in turning pagans away from false gods. And what happened as a result? Well, the economy of the city struggled, particularly with regard to the sale of idolatrous elements, right? Idolatrous statues, idolatrous literature, pagan things that pagans would embrace, would cherish, right? Talisman, things to ward off evil spirits, right? All kinds of pagan things devoted to the pagan gods. The sales of those things slipped, right? Which was the reason for this uproar. So the NIV says the assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there, right? Which is something that could be said of modern protests too, right? At any rate, the Jews in the crowd pushed Alexander at the front and they shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people, but when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Fellow Ephesians, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and her image, which fell from heaven? Therefore, since these facts are undeniable, you ought to calm down and do not do anything rash. You have brought these men here, though they have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess. If then Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. They can press charges." So, was this a religious gathering? No. It was a civil gathering prompted by Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen, right, because of their slump in Artemis sales, right? Artemis is obviously a religious figure, but these people weren't gathered together to worship Artemis or to engage in activity that could be construed as the worship of Artemis. This was a civil disturbance, a civil gathering. People came out of their homes to address this civil issue. "If there is anything further that you want to bring up, it must be settled in a legal assembly," right, in a Sanhedria. This is an ecclesia. This is a town council. This is an assembly of citizens to address a secular issue in the lives of the people of this community, right? But if they want to press charges, they can take it before a Sanhedria. "As it is, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of what happened today. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion, since there is no reason for it." And after he had said this, he dismissed the assembly, right? And the NIV translates the word ecclesia here as assembly. Why assembly? Because it's a duly convened assembly of citizens to address a civic purpose, right? But the proconsul speaking to them says, "Look, right, this civil disturbance is going to attract the attention of the Romans, right? So if you want to attract the attention of the Romans, knock yourself out. But I would suggest you all go home. And if something needs to be addressed in court, it can be. Let the people who forced this civil disturbance into existence, let them take the matter to court if they need to. But I would suggest that all of you go home, right? Which, by the way, is what happens. Now, notice this passage in Colossians chapter 4. And by the way, I could have had many passages from the apostolic writings, from the book of Acts, and from other passages. Give my greetings to the brothers and sisters at Laodicea and to Nympha. And notice the ecclesia, the church in her house. Right? So here the NIV translates the word ecclesia as church and not assembly. But was Nympha using her home for the convening of the town council? Is this what Paul was referring to? That Nympha opened her home so that the citizens of her community could gather together to discuss public issues? Is that what took place in Nympha's home? If not, then why is the word for a secular assembly in Greek being used for a non-pagan religious assembly? It shouldn't be, right? But this is the way that the vast majority of English translations of the apostolic writings translate these words. There is no consistency in the way these words are translated, right? Because the translating committees are attempting to push forward a religious agenda, right? A theological agenda. The fact is, because in the Jewish thought of the first century, people recognized that the Greek word ekklesia was being used as a substitute for kahal or kehillah. So it was a reference in Jewish thought to a religious assembly. Because in Jewish thought, we don't distinguish between the religious and the secular like they do in Greek, like we do in English, like we do in the English language. And a primary example of this, is the separation between church and state in the United States, right? There is supposed to be a separation between church and state. We have a secular government. We have people with individual religious interests, right? But according to the Constitution, it's illegal for the national government to impose religious instruction on its citizens. That's the way it worked in the Greek and Roman worlds as well. Okay, we're going to move on to number 2. Each of the tabernacle's dozens of components is individually listed and described. The roof coverings, wall panels, foundation sockets, pillars, braces, brackets, and curtains, the ark, the table, the menorah, the two altars, and even the wash basin and its pedestal. We are given the exact dimensions of each of these components, the materials out of which they were made, and the details of their design. Why? Probably because the tabernacle and its services has so little significance in terms of the real work of God, that is, facilitating the salvation of Christians through the Messiah. Is that why? Because the tabernacle has so little significance for biblical instruction, right? There is an incredible amount of detail in the chapters that describe the tabernacle. And you would think, given what we know about God, that those details would be important and the use of the tabernacle would be important. And the degree to which the earthly tabernacle mirrors the heavenly tabernacle and what actually goes on there, you would think that those details would be important. But the fact of the matter is, they're not. The story of creation, the entire creation, takes up 31 verses in Genesis chapter 1. The story of the flood takes up 4 chapters in Genesis chapters 6 through 9. The story of Abraham takes up 14 chapters in the Bible. The story of Jacob takes up 24 chapters, but 14 of those 24 chapters involve Joseph. There are 16 chapters devoted to the tabernacle in Exodus chapter 25 through 40. There are 9 chapters devoted to the millennial temple in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. And whole books devoted to other important events in the lives of God's people. For example, the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, 36 chapters details the people's experience in the wilderness, right? I mean, the book of Exodus includes some of those details, but as the book of Exodus concludes with the actual erection of the tabernacle and the filling of the tabernacle with God's presence, right? We move forward in the book of Numbers to talk about the wilderness experience. And of course, many of the things that happen in the wilderness are described in the book of Numbers. And in the book of Acts, there are 28 chapters, right, devoted to the development of a sect within Judaism, not a church, a sect within Judaism. And that's what is referred to in Acts 24, verses 5 and through 14, and Acts 28, verses 22. In other words, in the apostolic writings, generally, there is never a reference to a church. There is a reference to a sect of Judaism that is developing or evolving as a result of the death and the resurrection of the Messiah, right? But the word that is used to translate into English, the word church, is never used in Greek literature of a religious assembly, right? And it's always used in the apostolic writings the way the Greek word ekklesia is used in the Septuagint. And in the Septuagint, it translates the word kehillah, right? A religious assembly, a synagogue, people gathered together in messianic, in first century messianic congregations. So moving on to this last matter, the fact that on certain years, Vayikel and Pekudei are joined to form a single reading, it teaches us that we can and should achieve a synthesis of the two, a community that is not a faceless mass, but a community of individuals, each contributing his or her distinct personality and capabilities towards the communal goal, with the community in turn providing the framework within each can strive for his or her personal best. I'd like to talk about this issue in the context of this passage from 1 Corinthians 14. What shall we say, brothers? Is that the way the first sentence ends? No. Why not? Because a community is made up of brothers and sisters, right? It's not just a community of brothers. Although, given the way many people understand this passage, that's what you would think, right? But it's incorrect. What shall we say then, brothers or sisters and sisters? When you come together, each of the brothers should have a hymn or a word of instruction or a revelation or a tongue or an interpretation. Is that what it says? No, it doesn't say when you come together, each of the brothers should contribute something to the communal welfare. It says each of you should have a hymn, a word of instruction, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Who is the you expressed? It's the brothers and the sisters, right? So both brothers and sisters, when they gather together, should have a hymn or a word, God forbid, of instruction. My goodness. Paul, as it turns out, is being a bit radical here, isn't he? Well, no, not at all, since he's a rabbi and not a priest or a pastor, right? He's a rabbi. And this is the way synagogues work. This is the way they worked in the first century. There wasn't a separation between men and women in the first century synagogue. There are many people who will say there is, but there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever, either from the rabbinic literature or from archaeological excavations of early synagogues, that this is the case, right? The fact of the matter is that when the brothers and sisters gathered together as a community, each one of them was expected to bring a hymn or a word of instruction, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. But everything must be done so that the church, the ecclesia, may be built up. But of course, it's not a reference to a church. The word ecclesia means kehilah. That is the way everyone in Corinth would have understood what Paul was saying. Everything must be done so that the kehilah must be built up. The church wouldn't exist for another 100 years. If anyone speaks in a tongue, look at verse 27. Does it say if a brother speaks in a tongue? No. If anyone speaks in a tongue, two or at the most three should speak, one at a time, and someone must interpret. Not someone should interpret, someone must interpret. And if there is no interpreter, the speaker should keep quiet in the kehilah. Who is the speaker in this case? A brother or a sister? It could be either one, right? In other words, if a brother brings a tongue and there is no interpreter for that tongue, then the brother should keep his mouth shut, right? He should be quiet and not speak up at all. And he should speak to himself and to God instead. Two or three prophets should speak, and the others should weigh carefully what is said. And if a revelation comes to someone, a brother or a sister, who is sitting down, the first speaker should stop, whether it's a male or a female, right? The first speaker should stop. They should get to the end of what they're saying and stop so that the second brother or sister can speak, right? For you can all prophesy in turn. All you brothers and sisters can prophesy in turn so that everyone, both brothers and sisters, may be instructed and encouraged. The spirits of the prophets are subject to the control of the prophets. Look at verse 33, for God is not a God of disorder, but of peace, which is technically what this passage is about, right? Congregational order, right? The order of a worship service, as in all the congregations, right? The kehilot of the Lord's people. In verse 34, women should remain silent in the kehilah. They're not allowed to speak, but must be in submission, as the law says. Does that statement make any sense at all, given what Paul just said about what brothers and sisters have a responsibility to do when they gather together as a kehilah? When brothers and sisters gather together as a kehilah, they should each bring a hymn. How can a woman share a hymn if she has to remain quiet or silent? Can anybody hear a silent hymn? Can anybody hear a silent prophecy? Can anyone hear a silent tongue? Can anyone hear a silent encouragement? Can anyone hear a silent instruction? In what way is this silence intended to build up the community as a result of what women in the community bring to the congregation? Right? Paul just talks about what women are expected to bring to the congregation, and then he says in verse 34 that they can't talk. Right? Is that what the word silent means? As it turns out, no, it does not. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it's disgraceful for a woman to speak in the Kehillah. If it's disgraceful for a woman to speak in the Kehillah, then why does Paul instruct women that when they gather together as a part of a Kehillah, that they bring, you know, various qualities and characteristics to the instruction that are identical to that of men, right? It goes on to say, or did the word of God originate with you? Or are you the only people it has reached? If women are supposed to remain silent in the Kahal, then Paul's instruction in this same passage and earlier in this same letter does not make any sense whatsoever. And for some reason, it's very difficult to find anyone who is troubled by these things. If you look at the earlier passage in 1 Corinthians 11, every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? What's the issue in 1 Corinthians 11? Women praying out loud, which is what we do in a synagogue, by the way, or women prophesying out loud? It's just something that was done not only in biblical times. There are women prophets, right? And they don't communicate their prophecy silently or in writing, right? They speak it forth. And in fact, that's what the word prophecy means, to speak forth God's words, right? That's what a prophet does, whether it's a man or a woman. The issue in 1 Corinthians 11 is whether men dress like women or women dress like men, right? And that should not be done in a congregational setting because it's inappropriate. If you look at this passage from the Talmud, now Hannah, she spoke about her heart in 1 Samuel 1 about matters. So said Rabbi Elazar in the name of Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra that were in her heart. She spoke right up to the Holy One, Master of the Universe. Of all you have created in woman, there is not one part without its purpose. Eyes to see, ears to hear, a nose to smell. Boy, who in their right mind would add of a woman that she has a mouth to speak? That's what the mouth is for, speaking. And that's what it's for when it's connected to a woman's body, and that's what it's for when it's connected to a man's body, right? Women have eyes to see, ears to hear, noses to smell, mouths to speak, hands to work with, legs to walk, and breasts to give suck, right? Women obviously have different qualities, different characteristics, but many of them are the same as that of a man and should be used for the exact same purpose. In the Song of Songs, Rabbah, the Midrash, let us get up early to the vineyards. This refers to Israel. As it says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. Let us see whether the vine has budded. This refers to the recital of the Shema. Whether the vine blossom be opened. This refers to the synagogues and houses of study, and the pomegranates be in blossom. This refers to children busily learning the Torah. There will I give thee my love. There I produce the righteous men, notice, and women, the prophets and prophetesses who have risen from among me or have arisen from me. With whom does the word of God originate? God, right? The key in this passage is not that women should remain silent in the kahal, but that disorderly conduct in a worship service reflects a destructive arrogance on the part of everyone who contributes to it. Look at the way silence is mentioned in the Hebrew Bible. Submit yourselves to the Lord and supplicate him. Fret not yourself because of him that prospers in his way, at the man that does unlawful deeds. The Hebrew word dom, which is the word that Paul is thinking of when he writes his letter to the Corinthians, means to be or grow dumb, to be silent, or to be still, but not in the sense of not talking or not saying anything. It has to do with regard to one's relationship with God and their settled ability to trust God and to hope in him and to wait for him to accomplish his objective in our lives. Look at this passage in Psalm 37. Be still before the Lord, or be silent, it could be translated, before the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their way, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Why not? Because we're instructed to trust God, to be silent, to be still, to wait on the Lord. Is this an instruction just for women? No, of course not. It's intended for men too. As this passage in Psalm 4, be angry and do not sin. Meditate with your heart on your bed and be still. Be silent. Be quiet. Be reposed in your relationship with God, right? That's what this instructs us to be, and that's the instruction in 1 Corinthians 14. What were women doing that weakened the character of the kahal? Any of the following could have been disrupting the Corinthians' orderly service. Women, like men, may have been ministering without consideration of others, lacking self-control. But this is something true of men and women equally. Because women were less educated, they may have been interrupting the service by asking questions inappropriately, which is a possibility, which is a part of the reason why Paul may have said, you know, that when women do have a question about something that takes place in the service, they should ask their husbands at home or discuss it with others at home. Some of the women may have been reverting to the model of their pagan worship, disrupting the service with their loud noises. In pagan religions, the only way women were allowed to participate was by wailing and making high-pitched cries called ululations. You may be familiar with these. From Homer onward, there's a footnote if you're not. From Homer onward, writers described ululations, ululation. Among the pagans, the men ministered and offered sacrifice, while the women provided sound effects. Paul now expected all to minister, but in an orderly way, without the chaos of their pagan past. And Corinthia was known for struggling with its pagan past, right? So this is something that the women may have brought to the community. They may have brought their pagan style of worship and thought that that would be as useful in a congregational setting as it would in a pagan setting, but it isn't. If, as it seems likely, women were predominantly in that group of prophets who were disposed to be disorderly, Paul may, in chapter 14, verse 34, be addressing them specifically with regard to this matter of submission to other prophets for the sake of order and peace. These parallelisms in the imperatives to keep quiet and to be in submission strongly suggest that the problem of disorderly participation in prophetic proclamation in tongues was particularly prominent among women believers in Corinth. And that is, it is with respect to this context that Paul's admonitions must be understood, right? This passage that refers to what the law says is probably a reference to Leviticus 19, which encourages us to be loving and gracious in our relationships with others, with our neighbors, right, with other members, both men and women in the community. And there's a couple of passages that go along with that as well. The one last thing I would like to say is that it is probably not a reference to Genesis 3, which speaks about the fact that your husband will rule over you, given the fact that rulership and submission has nothing to do with the passage that we're talking about, right? So it's a misapplication of a biblical text to suggest that the passage from Genesis 3 is the passage that Paul is referring to when he refers to a citation in the Torah, given that the context of 1 Corinthians 14 is congregational proprietorship, right? It's the way things should be done in a congregation made up of a good deal of pagans from the city of Corinth and all the associated abuses that come along with that, right? Now, the fact of the matter is that this matter is addressed to the congregation in Corinth and not in others. And there are several passages which speak about walking in love, walking in obedience to God's commands. And finally, this statement at the end, chazak, chazak, venit, chazek. This is something that we say at the conclusion of a biblical book, a book of Torah. Be strong, and may we be strengthened. So, this is the way the entire congregation responds when the last aliyah of a book of the Torah is read, right? When the reader concludes, the congregation responds, chazak, chazak, venit, chazek. Be strong, and may we be strengthened. So, I apologize for the time over, but I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments or questions about what we've talked about. Anybody? I'll look at the comments in a minute.
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
I like in the beginning part where with the community that the people come first.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing, and I really like that part, how even though people come first, and then we work from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only is that evident in the Rebbe's teaching, and it comes up on more than one occasion, but it's interesting. I've been to a variety of religious, Christian and Jewish institutions all over the world, frankly. And one of the things that I've come to appreciate very much about Chabad, and the Rebbe is a Chabad, well, was a Chabad rabbi, but one of the things that I've always appreciated about Chabad is that their objective is to help people draw closer to God and to feel comfortable with whatever level of Judaism they are at a place of exploring at any given time. In other words, people are welcomed, and non-Jews too, are welcomed into the community, and their participation in the community is facilitated, right? So, this statement with regard to community and the importance of community and the value of the people in the community is something that is is emphasized in what they do and what they do regularly. It's been a blessing to actually see that in practice. And I have many, many, many times. So it's one of the nice things to see. Good. Thank you, Benita. That is an incredibly important idea. Good. There is a chat here. Let me just look at that real quick. Here's a chat from Warren. It would have simplified matters if the authors of the Septuagint had used the word synagogue to mean a religious assembly rather than ecclesia. It's not clear to me why they did. I can tell you why they did. They did not use the word synagogue. They did not translate the word kehilah into the word synagogue, because in Greek, synagogue can be any kind of religious assembly. And in the Bible, a kahal is never a pagan assembly. So in other words, in Greek, the reason why those scholars did not translate the Hebrew word kehilah into the Greek word synagogue is because the Greek word synagogue can apply to any pagan religious assembly, and in the Bible, the word kehilah never applies to a religious assembly, right? So they didn't want there to be confusion regarding what a kehilah was or is. They use the word ecclesia because it has no religious connotation in Greek, and they believed that they would be safe using that word because they did not want the word kehilah in Hebrew to be associated with anything remotely pagan, which would have been the case if they chose the word synagogue. Right? So that's why. Right? But you have to understand that in the first century, the Gentiles who worshiped God in synagogues, in kehilot. Right? So they would have been aware of what the word ecclesia meant in the first century and the way it was used by Jewish authors, not by Greek authors. No Greek author uses the word ecclesia of a religious setting, right? A religious gathering. But Jewish authors, they all do, right? They all do. And by the way, in the book of Acts, when the word synagogue is used, it's always qualified. It's always referred to as a synagogue of the Jews, right? A religious gathering of the Jews, right? Today, that's what the word synagogue means. It has no pagan association anymore, right? In English, the word synagogue is a synagogue of the Jews. When you go to a synagogue today, you don't expect to see there a coven of witches gathering together, or people engaged in a sexual orgy in the worship of the fertility goddess Diana or Artemis, right? I mean, the fact is that you expect to see Jews praying together as a community. That's what you expect, you know, when you attend a synagogue today. But that is not what could be expected in the first century, right? So it's a tremendous issue. Very good. Thanks, Warren. I appreciate the question.
That makes perfect sense. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the comment. From Rivka, realizing that the word epistles equals letters, as in a written letter to a person or a group, is a letter of a certain subject for a certain group of individual. Everything went south when the epistles, the letters, were equated with the Torah. This is Rivka makes the comment, her personal opinion. What I would say about everything went south. Everything went south when people stopped to recognize that when they were reading the letter to the Corinthians, for example, they were reading somebody else's mail. This is an incredibly important idea. The letter to the Corinthians was written to the congregation in Corinth. If you're in Galatia and you read a copy of Paul's letter to the Corinthians, do you apply everything in that letter to your circumstances in Galatia? No, you shouldn't, right? Because it was written to the congregation in Corinthians. If all the congregations were identical, if they had exactly the same issues, exactly the same leadership, exactly the same people, then fine. You can make a case like that. But, right, but Paul's letters, Peter's letters, right, when you read them, and this is true today, we are reading somebody else's mail. They're not for us. The principles are for us. We can apply the principles to our lives in exactly the same way we apply Torah principles to our lives, right? But the fact of the matter is, you know, like, for example, there's a Torah instruction to orchard owners, right, that they cannot collect all of the fruit from their orchard. For example, those pieces of fruit that have already dropped to the ground, they're not allowed to pick that up and to include it in their harvest, right? Because the fruit that drops to the ground is for animals. It's for people, right? People are allowed to come on to someone's property and to pick up fruit from the ground. And that's something that the Torah makes a provision for, right? I don't have an orchard. I don't have a vineyard. I'm not growing wheat or barley in my backyard. I don't have anything like that. So that Torah principle obviously doesn't apply to me, right? Wrong. That Torah principle does apply to me. Not in the exact same way it applies to a orchard owner or a vineyard owner, but the principle of caring, extending care to the poor is something I have to take into consideration, right? In the things that I receive from the Lord. So, that's the way these letters work. The principles apply to us, even though all of the details may not. Good. Thank you, Rivka. I appreciate that comment, too. From Susanna, so to clarify my understanding of 1 Corinthians 14, Paul is addressing what may have been happening specifically in the Corinthian Messianic synagogue, establishing instructions for order, that's correct, not making a restriction on women in the congregation. If correct, this is way different than what the Christian church teaches. You're absolutely correct. This is way different than what the Christian churches teach. Right? But the Christian churches, their theological perspective doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from Greek philosophy and what the Greeks believed about women, right? That's where Christian theology comes from. It does not come from the Bible. Either the Torah, the rabbinic literature, the apostolic writings, it comes from the church fathers, right? So, if there's anyone responsible for the way 1 Corinthians 14:34 is understood by the church, it has nothing to do with Paul. It has to do with the church fathers. And Paul should not be blamed for this kind of nonsense. And I apologize for using such a strong word, but I regard this kind of teaching not only as nonsense, but as horrifically destructive, right? I regard it as destructive. It has destroyed the lives of many women and many churches, right? Be- because half the people on the planet that God raised up to facilitate his objective aren't allowed to participate. I don't know about you, but I mean, when you make something, do you make two of something when you need one and then throw the second away? I mean, is that what you do? Is that part of what you're planning, right? So when I put the walls up for my library, I got twice as much drywall as I needed, right? I used half of it and threw the other half away, right? Does anyone do that? Well, that apparently is what God has done with women, isn't it? He created woman and then restricted her from doing anything meaningful in life. Oh, excuse me, except for having children, right? Which is what the church fathers emphasize too, right? That's what a woman's job is, having children. And if it wasn't having children, if it wasn't for having children, everybody from the early church fathers through Martin Luther made a comment that what point is there to a woman, right? They can't really help a man in the things a man does, right? All they're good for is having children. And if they die in the childbearing process, too bad, so sad, right? That's just what happens sometimes, right? No consideration given to women at all, right? And frankly, it's remarkable that women have put up with it for so long. Any other comments before we go? I have stepped down off my soapbox, so you're all safe. Anybody else?
Rabbi said, I was going to say that this lesson kind of emphasizes the need to study from multiple translations. Because, for instance, the reference to 1 Corinthians 14 and the complete Jewish Bible, it does say, it says brothers, and stops there. And the King James, it says believers. It doesn't reference the gender, which seems to be more inclusive. So this was a confusing lesson for me when it seemed like we were going back and forth, but I understand now. And again, your advice about studying from multiple translations is definitely important.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And by the way, when references, unfortunately, when reference is sometimes made to men in English translations of the apostolic writings, it should say mankind, but it's singularized, even though that's not what the word means. Right? In other words, sometimes references to mankind generally, or to humanity generally, or to believers generally, or to a community generally that is made up of both men and women, are masculinized to exclude women from the instruction. It's another reason why multiple translations are so important. I agree. Yep, absolutely. So, Ed, I appreciate you bringing that up. Very good. Anybody else before we go?
Another comment?
Yeah, of course.
No, in the chat.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate you looking at that. Okay, here's another comment from Susanna. Can you please comment? I heard a disturbing teaching recently on Rabbinic Judaism that someone believes, Rabbinic Judaism teaches the Shekinah glory of God is released or can be attained, brought into presence by performing mitzvot, good works, and is not a result of a changed heart or repentance, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. I've never heard a statement like that made, although, I mean, it's not impossible that a rabbi might teach something like that, but it certainly is not characteristic of Rabbinic Judaism the presence of God, which is what the Shekhinah in Hebrew, is typically referred to as God's presence. The presence of God is something facilitated by the relationship that the people in the community have with God, right? So, for example, when God spoke to his people in the wilderness and told them to build the tabernacle, their follow-through is what facilitated the ability of God to dwell among them, right? His presence dwell among them, and to fill and to fill the tabernacle with his presence, right? So, had they not made the tabernacle, God obviously could not have filled the tabernacle with his presence. Since they did, since they obeyed him, since they did make the tabernacle according to his instructions, it was something he could do. It was something he could facilitate, right? But, of course, that goes together, at least in rabbinic thought and in the teaching of the apostolic writings. You know, the doing of whatever it is that we do goes together with the heart that makes it meaningful, right? And those two things have to go together. And one is not particularly meaningful without the other. At least, that's what both the rabbis and apostolic authors teach. Faith without works is dead, right? Faith by itself without works is dead. And if all we have is a heart for someone or something but don't do anything about it, then what good is it, right? So those things go together. And God in the passages that speak about the tabernacle not only talks about indwelling the tabernacle, filling it with his presence, but filling the community with his presence, right? Indwelling each of the members of the community. That was God's objective. And according to the scriptures, that's what happens. God fills the community with his presence. We've talked about that several times too. Good. Thank you, Susanna. This person making what I would consider a blanket statement about Judaism, relaying again that Judaism, a religion of works to obtain something, wrong thinking, in my opinion. I agree. Wrong thinking. The rabbis do not, and this is an unequivocal, do not teach that salvation is obtained by works of the Torah. It's typically Christians who believe that. But that's because that's what Christians are taught and were taught by the early church fathers about Judaism. So this teaching, which still characterizes Christian theology today, has been around for close to 2,000 years. It's what the early church fathers taught about Judaism to distinguish the works orientation of Judaism from the grace orientation of Christianity, right? But in Judaism, there is no works orientation to salvation. There is only a grace orientation to salvation in Judaism, right? And anyone who teaches otherwise is simply not familiar with Judaism or rabbinic literature, right? In other words, They're simply repeating what they have been taught by a pastor, not by what they've read in the text. That's the way it works, sadly. Very good. Anybody else before we go? There we go. Hey, Keith. By the way, I always mention this when this discussion comes up. The people of Israel were redeemed from Egypt before they received the Torah. So the giving of the Torah or the observing of the Torah can't have anything to do with their redemption. Redemption comes first, and then walking in God's ways. And that's the way it should be for all believers, right? Salvation, redemption comes first. We become a child of God, and then we walk in our Father's ways. That's just the way it works. There's nothing salvific about the Torah. And you won't find anything said in the rabbinic literature about something salvific about the Torah. I can only think of one passage in which salvation is associated with Torah observance, and that comes from one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the Essene documents, right? But it's one statement in one of 200 Dead Sea Scroll manuscripts, 200,000 fragments, pieces of literature, right? No statement is ever made. Frankly, all you have to do is attend a synagogue service once, and you'll come away from the service realizing that salvation and Torah observance don't have anything to do with each other. Right? I mean, it's woven into the liturgy of the Amidah. It's something that every Jew recites every day. Right? So, also from Rivka, when I began going to shul, to synagogue, I was asked, "Who are you? Where do you come from? And why are you here?" And that was that. When I began going to church, age 28, I was given a list of do's and don'ts and was watched like a hawk. I always felt creeped out. Yeah. And that's because in a synagogue, nobody really cares what you believe. Right? And that's what churches are built on, doctrine. They're built on theological doctrine, right? In other words, if you're a Catholic going to a Baptist church, for example, regardless of what kind of relationship you have with God, Baptists regard your baptism as invalid, right? Because it wasn't done in the Baptist church, right? So that's the way most churches, that's what they believe about baptism. You have to be baptized in our church in order to be a member here. And you have to agree with our statement of faith. Synagogues don't have statements of faith because Jews, when we gather together to pray, right? To worship God. That's what we gather together for. And it's possible for us to believe different things and still gather together as a community to pray. Right? So, thank you, Rivka. I appreciate that insight. She says shul, not shell, of course. That's the value of, correction, spelling corrections. I was called into the pastor's office numerous times for being a rebellious woman. Right? And, of course, being a rebellious woman is defined as a woman who has an opinion about something, right? That's a rebellious woman. It has nothing to do with rebellion. It has to do with having an opinion about something or having a question about the text, right? That's a rebellious woman. Good. Anyway, thank you, Shelley. Anybody else before we go? Okay. Well, my game is probably over at this point, so I'm not in any big hurry to get back to it, but no problem. We're having snow tomorrow. I don't know about you other guys in the Midwest, but in Minnesota, it takes a good deal of time for spring and winter to battle out who's in charge. And So this is another example of winter making its effects felt, even though we are now well into spring. Bob, you got a comment? Okay.
I have one.
Yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Some before we leave, I was in reading this section. Something confusing me about with Moses is, which I know that Aaron and his sons were allowed to go into the Holy of Holies, and it mentions something about that Moses wasn't to go in, but Moses still was able to experience God up on Sinai. So was Moses able to go into the Holy of Holies?
No.
He wasn't.
No, only the sons couldn't go in either. Only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies.
But he still heard from God on the... But I guess, is it because of order? Is that why God done it that way?
That's a good question. I think because the restriction has to do with the heavenly tabernacle and the work of Messiah at the heavenly tabernacle, right? Because the high priest is in effect. He has a role similar to that of the Messiah at the earthly tabernacle. So just as the Messiah takes his blood, according to the Gospels, and enters in to the most holy place of the heavenly tabernacle, so the high priest is the only one who has access to the Holy of Holies in the earthly tabernacle. That's what I would say. Right? So, by the way, the fact that the presence of God fills the tabernacle and fills the community, that has nothing to do with the experience of individuals with God. Moses' experience with God was obviously unique. Because Aaron was the high priest, during Aaron's life, he was the only one who ever set foot in the Holy of Holies. Right? Obviously, when the tabernacle was being moved and it was being taken apart, the other members of the Levitical tribes, would have participated in its taking apart and boxing up and preparing for travel and travel. Right? So, but that would not have occurred during a service, right? The only one who could enter the Holy of Holies during a service was the high priest, whoever that happened to be at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was making it like we're doing, this is why we are here to study Torah, because I would make the assumption that because Moses was able to experience God on Mount Sinai, then he should have had the right to go into the Holy of Holies. I'm making assumptions because of things, but that's not how it works.
Yeah. By the way, Yeshua could not have entered the Holy of Holies of the earthly temple either. Right? He was from the tribe of Judah.
I didn't see that.
Right. Okay. As a Levite, I could have drawn closer to the temple precinct than Yeshua could have in the first century.
Oh, okay.
But that's the earthly temple, right? But that's because he was from the tribe of Judah, not Levi, and had no Aaronic priestly role with regard to the earthly temple or tabernacle, but he obviously does have a role in the heavenly one, which the earthly tabernacle is a representation of.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Keith. Appreciate that. Good comments. Very good. Anybody else before we go? You guys are great. I love the comments that are made and the discussion that we have. Always worthwhile. Yeah, Rivka provides us a biblical, in this particular case, the separation of church and state, where she mentions the example of Saul and how much trouble he got into for offering a sacrifice to God at a time when, of course, the priests were the only ones to offer sacrifices to God, right? So even in biblical times, there was a kind of a division of responsibility in the nation generally, right? There were prophets, priests, and kings, and they all had different functions in the community.
Thanks, Rivka. Thank y'all for this, because it gives me more to think about, but also for me to not take things for granted. So, again, I always make assumptions that not always right.
Yeah. Yep. Assumptions can be very difficult sometimes. Very good. Thank you, Rivka. Well, it's pouring down rain here, and we have a winter weather advisory coming, so I expect we're going to have some difficult weather between now and tomorrow sometime. So, very good. God bless you guys. May the Lord be with you. Good to see everybody. I'll look forward to seeing you during the week. Bye for now.
Take care, all.
God bless.
Thank you, Rabbi. God bless everyone.
Pleasure. God bless you guys.